Okay, so let me first thank Stefan and Monique for inviting me here. It's a wonderful opportunity. I've seen a lot of practitioner conferences about this topic, but I haven't seen any academic or a very nice combination of academics and practitioners in the same conference. So this is a wonderful opportunity for this area of research. So I'll be presenting two things today. I'll look at capital structure arbitrage. So yesterday we saw a very nice guided tour of capital structure arbitrage presented by Jean-Pierre. And yesterday's talks were focusing on the modeling side and calibration. And today what I'm going to present is focusing more on the empirical side. So today we'll actually look at empirical data and how things work in practice. So the title of this talk is How Profitable is Capital Structure Arbitrage? So my focus is not so much as looking at the modeling side, but just look at how the market works and how this strategy is implemented in practice by traders. And so I'll look at some really simple models and look at a broad based data set. So I'll have to probably skip over a few slides because we had the talks yesterday. So this one is just some quotes from the magazines and the press. I got started in this topic about 2 years ago, and when I read this article from Euromoney, and there you get the sense that people are really excited about this strategy. So terms like most significant development or the hottest strategy, and you also get the sense that hedge funds are also starting to use this strategy. So everybody knows what a credit default swap is, so I'll probably skip over this. Capital structure arbitrage refers to the use of structural models to gauge the richness and cheapness of the CDS spread. And the model is typically based on Merton. And so when a trader uses the model to calculate a spread, and he then compares the spread to the market spread, and depending on the differences, he would put on trades. So that's the idea of capital structure arbitrage. And then using different classes of securities to hedge, to cross-hedge each other. That's the essence of the strategy. So, well, if there's a difference between these two time series, the market spread and the model spread, then several things can be going on. And this is the sense that you get by reading these articles. Well, one, first of all, people could think that the CDS market might actually be signaling information in the market. So in that sense, the equity market might be too slow in reacting. So this is one way of thinking about this. Another way of thinking about this is maybe the CDS market, because it is a growing market and it's not as mature as the equity market, it actually is affected by demand and supply effects. So this causality can go both ways. So depending on which view the trader takes, then he's going to put on different positions. And just in case he might guess wrong, then he actually does both. He uses equity to hedge the CDS position. Now, once you are using a model to do this sort of trading, immediately that raises a red flag, which is the model itself can be misspecified. So, and as we saw from yesterday's talks, that there are lots of issues with how to choose these models. And another thing that I think it's perhaps as important is that even if you have the perfect model, that the inputs to the model can be mismeasured as well. So choosing volatility, what volatility to put in there, historical volatility versus implied volatility, or the balance sheet variables, they're not up to date. If you are doing research with a large database, then you can only do so much. We don't have updated information about the company's balance sheets or debt. So that's going to affect the results of the implementation. So in this paper, I'm looking at a few questions. Well, apparently that this is not going to be arbitrage in the textbook sense. So if it's taking risk, as they call risk arbitrage, what is the risk involved? And so, and then what is the risk and return of the strategy? And you can think of this in two different ways. One is looking at individual trades. What is the risk and return? and you think of this in terms of the histogram of the risk of the strategy returns. Another way of thinking about this is, suppose you are a trader and you're not just doing one trade, you're doing a portfolio of trades. So you have a portfolio of capital structure arbitrage trades. What is the risk and return in that sense? In that case, you might think about systematic risk. Is the returns that you're getting just compensation for taking systematic risk? So those are the things that we might look at if you have a large number of trades. So and also, without looking at an equilibrium asset pricing model, running those factor regressions, you can look at whether the strategies constitute statistical arbitrage. So if I have time, I'll get to talk about that as well. Related literature to this, there are a few papers in this area. Most of them are looking at bond pricing and not CDS. So using structural models to price corporate bonds, and it turns out that I think a lot of people know that the performances are not that good. And this was shown very early by a paper 20 years ago, Jones, Mason, and Rosenfeld, and more recently by RFS paper in 2004, looking at other types of structural models. And they show that these models underpredict spreads, and so overpricing those bonds. Now, there's a working paper by people at McGill, Erickson, Runaby, and Wong, and they actually show that if you use the structural models to price credit default swaps, then it actually performs quite well. And the reason it perhaps is because corporate bond prices are notorious for having liquidity and tax components. So, and CDS could perhaps is a cleaner measure of default risk. The methodology in this paper is very similar to a paper on equity arbitrage strategies, Mitchell and Paulvino, and it's also similar to another paper I have with Jefferson Duarte and Francis Longstaff, which is the next paper I'm going to talk about. So the methodology is we're studying these returns, and we're not taking returns from hedge funds reported by hedge funds. We're just building these returns ourselves, sort of a bottom-up approach. What are they doing, and if we can get data, how do we actually construct these returns ourselves? So that's our that's my strategy here in this paper. And by the way, capital structure arbitrage doesn't. So in this paper, I'm looking at capital structure arbitrage as trading equity and CDS together. It doesn't have to be that. It could be actually trading bonds against CDS, and there is a theoretical relationship between bond spreads and CDS spreads. Or you can look at bonds against trading bonds against equities, and there are all these papers looking at these relationships across these different securities. There's also some papers looking at lead-lag relationships across different markets, bonds, CDS, and equity. And the predominant evidence there shows that bond markets are always lagging behind CDS or equity, but there is no clear causality, lead-lag relationships in the CDS market versus the equity market. Just came across a working paper by some people at LBS looking at the so-called insider trading in the CDS market. And they actually found that the CDS market is leading equity, especially when there is bad news. So they interpret that as insider trading in the CDS market. So for pricing CDS, this is very basic relationships. And I assume all the standard assumptions. For example, recovery rate is a constant level. And I also assume independence between default-free interest rate and the default process, so you can actually factorize them. So this P here is the default-free bond price, and the Q is the survival probability. And so Q prime is the density of the survival probability, or minus that is the density of the survival probability. So this one is actually, so setting the two legs, the present value of the two legs of the CDS equal gives you the CDS spread on a freshly issued contract. But if you're doing trading, that's not just the only thing. That gives you the trading signal, but when you're holding these positions, you would actually have to compute the value of the positions. Well, we don't have any database that give us those contract values, so we have to compute them according to models. So we need to mark the value of those contracts to a model. And so I'll talk about specific model that I will use, but you can show that this is a general relationship. The value of the contract is equal to the change in the CDS spread and multiplied by the value of an annuity, and this annuity is contingent on survivorship. So basically, this is a survivorship bias, survival probability from T to S. Okay, and of course, in a structural model, this survival probability will be dependent on the equity price. So that means you can take a partial derivative of this relative to the stock price, and that gives you the equity delta. So the model I'm using here, this is a big, we're talking about credit grades here, and we have one of the authors of the model here. And this is a simple structural model developed by all these people from investment banks. And I think it's a model that was invented to be a benchmark model for people to calculate credit default swap spreads or credit risk. And this model is based on Black and Cox, the first passage model, diffusion-based. And it adds another element of uncertain recovery, and this element is built in to ensure that the short-term spreads will be sufficiently high. Now, I'm not in the industry, so I don't really know what models are currently being used. But from just reading these articles, I get the sense that this is the model that most people use, or at least this is what they're using to tweak around when they were looking at capital structure arbitrage. So that's going to be the model that I'm using for this paper. So I'm not trying to see which model works and which model is the best. I'm just saying if people are using this model for trading, what is the risk and return profile that they get by using this model with this strategy? So the model is fairly straightforward. It's a diffusion-based with no drift, and the debt per share is D, and this L here is the captures the default threshold as a percentage of debt per share. And this is actually random. It has a mean value of L bar, and then it depends on this normal random variable in this way. And so lambda, it really captures the uncertainty in this default threshold. Now, asset volatility, equity volatility, these two are assumed to be related in this very simple relationship, presumably a linearized version of a nonlinear relationship. So this simple model would imply that based on these seven inputs, you can calculate a CDS spread. So what are the seven inputs? We have the equity price, share price, the debt per share, the equity volatility, this average default threshold variable, and its uncertainty, and the risk-free rate, and the bond-specific recovery rate. Okay, now turning to data that I'm using here, I got this data from Market, and the data coverage is 5-year CDS on North American obligors, so about 1,000 of those for 4 years, and it's daily data. So it's a daily summary spread. So there's another database called Credit Trade, and that one is intradaily data, so you actually get quotes. Initially, I got that database, but that database was not very high quality, and I actually had to compute the summary daily spreads from intradaily data. And now that I actually have this database, this is much larger in terms of coverage. So I apply some filters to the data. First of all, I have to merge this data with stock price data from CRISP and also from the balance sheet data from CompuStat. And after you do the merging, you lose coverage. And also I require, because I'm using this for trading, I'm requiring a pretty continuous daily coverage. So no more than a 2-week break in a time series. So if you have more than 2 week break, that means there's something wrong with the market. Either the liquidity has disappeared or something like that, and you have to throw that out. So finally, I have more than 135,000 observations on 261 firms. So that's my sample, and this is how the sample size grows over time. So this reflects this exponential growth in the CDS market in the past decade. Okay. This is the summary statistics on the sample, and I'm breaking them down. The most meaningful thing is to look at it by credit rating. This is the, I think this is the average rating for the company in the sample period. So 80% are investment grade, the first four, and about 20% are non-investment grade or speculative grade junk bonds, the last three categories. And if you look at the spread, SPD is the CDS spread, the average spread over time, and also in these rating categories. And there's a monotonic relationship here increasing with rating as rating goes down. And the equity volatility also turns out to be increasing. And the same is true for leverage. So as the firms are having lower credit quality, both volatility and leverage are increasing. And the size is decreasing. This is the total market capitalization. The most interesting thing, I think, is the correlation. This is what I computed as the correlation between the daily change in the CDS spread and the daily change in the equity price. Okay? And so it, according to structural models, this should be negative. And so as share price rises, the CDS spread should go down. And so indeed, they're almost all negative. And the size of this is actually increasing as rating is going down. So this, you often hear that people think that junk bonds are behaving more like equity and investment grade bonds are behaving more like treasuries. So this is, you get the sense of this from looking at the correlations. And also the structural models turn out to do a better job for junk bonds than for investment grades. And you also get the supporting evidence here. The correlation between equity and CDS is simply much higher for junk bonds than for investment grade. Yes? No, I haven't. No, I haven't done that. The volatility is what I'm using here is a historical, a very long period, almost a 1,000-day rolling window historical volatility. So that is, that measure is not very volatile. Now, just to draw some intuition from this exercise, I picked up a company, and I picked Altria, which used to be called Philip Morris. And I picked this because it starts with the letter A, so it's at the beginning of my sample. Second of all, it's got a long coverage, almost continuous coverage for the 4 years. So there's an interesting story behind this. Is this company is hit with these class action lawsuits. So in early 2003, a judge in Illinois ordered the company to post $12 billion in a bond to appeal a class action lawsuit. So at that time, the people were worried that the company might not be able to survive. And so indeed, on March 31st, 2003, Moody's actually downgraded the company by two notches from A2 to Baa1. So the trading analysis, then actually this shows up in the pictures as well. So first of all, in terms of estimating the model, it's what I do is really simple. So I just look at the manual for this model, which is called the Credit Grades Technical Document. And I set the lambda, which measures the fluctuation, the randomness in the default threshold, and I set that to be 0.3, and it was recommended by the document. Presumably, the people there did some analysis across all of the firms, and they chose lambda to be 0.3. So I did that, and they also recommended using the 1,000-day historical equity volatility, so I used that as well. The debt per share is, I used the simple measure, which is just the total liabilities divided by shares outstanding. And here's something I do differently from the technical manual is the manual actually suggests that setting L bar to be 0.5, so the default threshold is 50% of the face value of debt, And then it actually uses a bond-specific recovery rate picked up from a J.P. Morgan proprietary database. Now, I don't have access to that, so what I did was, I think it's more palatable, is when I was talking to friends in the industry, they told me that they set LBAR to be 0.5, and then what they did was they actually calibrate the model, the recovery rate, to fit the CDS spread that they see in the market. But in doing that, they found that sometimes the recovery rate doesn't make any sense at all. Sometimes it has to be negative, sometimes it's very close to one. And I think Jean-Pierre mentioned that in yesterday's talks, that the people have to be careful about what these implied parameters are, whether they actually make sense. So my friends are telling me that sometimes they get these nonsensical calibrated parameters. So I think it's more makes more sense to me if you set the bond-specific recovery rate to be 0.5, and this is the senior unsecured recovery rate on a historical analysis, close to 50%. And of course, that's changing with the business cycle, so I'm ignoring a lot of things here. And I let the data tell me what L bar is. And we know that there are lots of structural models where, let's say, bankruptcy decisions are endogenous. Managers actually choose when to file for bankruptcy. And that decision depends on a lot of firm characteristics like asset volatility or the payout rate or some other parameters. So I find it more reasonable to let the data tell me what is the L-bar parameter. In other words, some firms may behave as if they really want to go bankrupt really early on, so the L-bar would be different from another firm. So I don't have a specific model to capture that aspect, but I'll just let this L-bar tell me what it is. So I fit this model using the first 10 daily spreads, and I get L-bar to be 62%. So the default threshold is 62% of the debt face value. So this is the graph that I'm getting here. So the dotted line is the model spread, and the black line, this is the top panel here. The black line, the solid line, is the market spread. The dotted line is the model spread. And one aspect that you see right away is that the market spread is a lot more volatile than the predicted spread. But on the other hand, you see that there is a correlation, negative correlation between the market spread, CDS spread, and the equity price. So you see these three episodes of rising CDS spreads, and they all correspond to decreasing equity prices. And the equity volatility doesn't change that much because it's a five-year historical volatility. So when you look at this picture, you realize that as a trader, that these are the periods that would trigger a trade. So when you look at this type of strategy, you look at the deviation between the market spread and the model spread, and when that deviation reaches a certain level, you would put on a trade. So this peak, for example, would of course correspond to a trade actually being put on. Well, so that depends on your trading trigger level. So when do you trade? Do you trade when the gap reaches 50 basis points or 100 basis points? So this of course depends on the person who actually does the trading. So I assume actually a very simple strategy here. Of course, this actually raises an interesting issue. Once you enter into a trade, let's say you enter a trade right here. Let's say when the market spread is, let's say, about 100 basis points more than the model spread. Well, when you enter a trade like that, you short CDS and then you short equity as a hedge. It turns out that the market spread continues to go up to close to 500 basis points. So if you put on the trade at this point, there is a possibility that you're going to lose a lot because the CDS spread is going to continue to go up. And this is actually a very dramatic case. When you analyze a big data set like this, you see that this actually happens a lot. So my trading strategy is like this. I look at the difference between these two spreads. This is the market spread and this is the model spread. If they deviate by a percentage level, alpha, and this is called a trading trigger, then you enter a trade. It could be short, it could be long, depending on which one is higher than the other. And this position is hedged with the hedge ratio from the credit grades model. And Jean-Pierre mentioned this point about the hedge ratio. What hedge ratio do you use? Do you use the hedge ratio corresponding to the model spread or corresponding to the market spread? And so I actually play around with this different hedging schemes in the paper. Now, this position is held for a fixed number of days or until convergence, where convergence is defined as these two time series becoming equalized again. Okay. And also, in this strategy, the returns to this strategy is going to depend on your initial capital. And if your initial capital is pretty low, then at some point you're going to run out of capital. And when you run out of capital, because of limited liability assumptions, I have to assume that the positions are liquidated. Okay. You can, of course, set a sufficiently high capital level to make sure that this doesn't happen, but this, again, is subject to experimentation. Okay, so the value of the contract is, once again, is depend. So it's the changes in the CDS spread. So this is a freshly issued contract here, and suppose you're holding it for 6 months, that contract becomes a secondary, it's not a freshly issued contract, a five-year contract becomes a four-and-a-half-year contract. And where do you get a quote for that? I don't have a quoted spread on that particular contract. So what I do is actually I approximate this by another freshly issued contract. So basically saying that the term structure from 4.5 years to 5 years is flat. So I think that's a reasonable assumption here. To summarize this case study, the risk of this, I'm actually comparing this to the next paper I'm presenting about other types of fixed income arbitrage strategies, and it turns out that the risk depends on the accuracy of the hedging that you put on here. And so the risk is about 10 times larger than a typical swap spread arbitrage. And I'll actually explain what I mean when we go through the second part of the this talk. Now, the large negative returns occurred in this particular case because the arbitrager traded too early. So that was the case that I mentioned. You were going short, but then you were going short too early, that actually after you have gone short, the CDS spread is continuing to move up. Okay, so those are the episodes that actually brought large negative losses. Now, of course, when you raise the trading threshold, the likelihood for such negative returns is going to go down. Okay, now, with the large holding period, when you can actually change the holding period from 30 days to, let's say, 180 days, when you change, increase the length of the holding period, more trades will converge. Okay, so this is a lot of intuitive results. I'm not going to look at these let you draw your attention to these numbers because it's not a whole lot of, it's difficult to read this. This is the histogram when you had a 10% capital. This is the histogram when you have 50% capital. So you see here, actually, going back to this table here, you see that with the 10% capital, you could have minimum losses of more than 100%. So what happens is when you reach 100% losses, you lose all your capital and you're supposed to get out of the market, but then you can only get out the next day, and so your loss actually exceeds 100%. So this illustrates that there could be very large losses from putting on capital structure arbitrage, especially when you don't have a sufficient level of capital. So it could be very risky. So this is not a textbook case of arbitrage. It's very far from that. When you look at all obligors, all 261 of them, the pattern is very similar. So I actually did a sort of a very casual inspection of all these pictures. So I find that you can roughly put them in three categories. And so this is how I divided them. So the first category is the middle column here. So you look at things like AT&T, McDonald's, Toys R Us. And what I did was, remember, I fit the spreads I fit the spreads using the first 10 days at the beginning. And I don't do any, so the model is completely fixed, and I just let the model run forward for the rest of the sample period. Of course, you can refit the model periodically, And what that does, it eliminates a lot of the spurious trades. It's going to increase the risk and return trade-off. That's going to make the returns more attractive. But what I do is something very simple. I just fix the model at the beginning, and I don't change it at all. Okay, so if you will, that this represents a lowest, the bottom line case for the risk and return of this strategy. So if I actually show that you can have an attractive risk and return trade-off, that is that would be a very interesting result. So for this category, what you see here is that the market spread, again, you know, this bounces around the model spread, but invariably everything will converge. Okay, so you see that in all three cases. And then there's this category. We have the two airlines. I think I heard these airlines being mentioned yesterday as well. This is American Airlines. I think this was a case being mentioned as not defaulting, but equity price has gone to virtually zero. And this is Delta, a very similar case, another airline. And this is WorldCom. This one actually filed for bankruptcy. So what happens in these cases is that at the beginning, you see the two series are fairly close together. But then after some point, this is where you have a financial distress, that the market spread will go to a very high level. This is close to 1,500 basis points, and this is even close to 2,000. But then the model spread remains fairly low, so there's a huge gap between these two series. So the model sort of doesn't explain what happens in the market. And then there's no convergence because that's as much as the series will go, and there's no more data after that, which indicates that there is a liquidity problem in the market. There is no trading. There's no one offering quotes. So if you are in the market, then you're stuck. That's the liquidity crunch problem that we have. So what I could do is, the only thing I could do is assume that you have to get out of the position at whatever prices are out there. And so in that case, you'll be making a huge loss. So it would be very similar to the peak that we saw for Altria. Okay? And then there's this, so these are, these one are the money makers, that these are the convergence cases. And these are the bad cases because they don't converge and you get financial distress. And these are the case, the last category here, you see the two series are trending apart without major significant news in the market. And so this could be attributed to model misspecification. So the model doesn't assume any drift. If you incorporate a drift, you might be able to solve these divergences. Okay. So I'm just roughly dividing those into three categories. They're otherwise very similar to the Altria case. Now, one thing that's fairly interesting is I divided them into investment grade and speculative grade. And the initial capital is 50 cents for $1 notional. And this is the holding period. It could be 1 month or 6 months. And this alpha is the trading trigger level. It could be 50%, 100%, or 200%. Now, when you look at investment grades and looking at this these three rows here, when you raise the trigger level, and I think I mentioned that if you raise the trigger level, you might avoid some of the problems with trading too early. So that actually helps having higher mean returns. But for the case of the speculative grade obligors, actually goes the opposite way. By raising the trading trigger level, you actually have declining mean returns. I think that's because of this financial distress problem. So if you look at speculative grades firms, that they're more likely to go bankrupt. So if you look at if the trading trigger is very high, that they might actually be permanent. They just go into financial distress and they don't recover. So you might actually lose a lot. So that, I think that's a fairly interesting thing. Now, what I did, one more thing in this paper is, so all this is just looking at individual trades, looking at, this is the histogram of the returns. I think it might be interesting to look at it from a diversified perspective. So if you are a trader, you might not just put on one trade. If you are a bank and if you're looking at all across these trades, you might look at a portfolio of trades. A large number of trades. So what happens when you aggregate them into portfolios? When you think about hedge funds, they might be doing a number of these things at the same time. So what is the risk and return that they're getting? So what I did was for each trade, I can look at daily excess returns, so taking out the risk-free rate, looking at the daily returns for individual trades every day, and then every day you actually have more than one trade. You might have a trade put on yesterday, a trade that was put on 5 months ago that has not converged or has not been liquidated yet. So at any given day, you might have hundreds of trades across these 261 obligors. So for every day, I can compute an equally weighted average. So taking the perspective that you are a hedge, you are a trader, and you're placing your trades across these hedge funds where every hedge fund represents a single trade. Okay? And so this is a diversified perspective. Now, after you get the daily average returns, you can aggregate them across into a monthly return, and this is where people can think of standard asset pricing regressions, factor regressions. You can say whether what is the systematic risk in this portfolio. So I did that, and it turns out that so this is the Sharpe ratio. This is the annualized Sharpe ratio, and the Sharpe ratio is the return subtracting the risk-free rate and then normalized by the volatility, the annualized volatility. And this number here, 0.4, 0.8, 0.7, this is very similar to the Sharpe ratios of the hedge fund return indexes, that they would publish Sharpe ratios of these indexes. And it turns out to be very similar to this. When you look at, let me go on. Before I ran these factor regressions, I did something else. I tested whether you can actually get a statistical arbitrage out of this. And a statistical arbitrage is a long horizon trading strategy, which is self-financing. It has positive expected discounted profits, and it's got a probability of a loss converging to zero. And it also has a time averaged variance, again, converging to zero. So it's a little bit like an arbitrage, but it's not a strict arbitrage. Now, it is a long horizon trading strategy, so the way you implement this is every month you borrow a dollar at the risk-free rate, and then you invest it in this strategy, this capital structure arbitrage. And then when you get any profits, you put it back into the risk-free rate, the risk-free account, money market account. And you just keep going, and then you discount the incremental profits back to time zero, and you get a sequence of incremental profits. Yes? Oh, just as time increases. Yeah. So every month you get an incremental profit, which is discounted back, and you can look at the variance of that incremental profit. So as t goes to infinity, this thing goes to zero. Yeah. So you can actually estimate these things using maximum likelihood, and this notion is actually in this General Financial Economics paper by Jarrell, among others. So I looked at that, and this lambda here is the exponent of the variance parameter, and the fact that this is negative indicates that the average variance is declining over time, and the mu is the mean. The mean value of the discounted profit, and that should be positive. And indeed, this is positive, although it doesn't have statistical significance because the standard deviation is pretty high as well. But the signs are all correct. So this indicates that this could be a statistical arbitrage if you look at maybe the data sample is not sufficiently long. We only have 4 years. But if you collect 10 years of data, maybe we don't know what's going to happen to capital structure arbitrage in 10 years, but the data might speak with more accuracy. Okay, and finally, I regressed the monthly returns on a number of market risk factors, including equity risk, equity market factors, bond market factors, and also the fixed income arbitrage index published by the Task Tremont by Credit Suisse First Boston. Now, I don't find any of the included factors to be significant, but on the other hand, when we looked at the short side of the strategy only, we find that the returns are negatively related to economy-wide default risk. So this is getting to that when these obligors are running into financial distress, you might suffer a huge loss. And this is if you only look at the short side and not the long side. I did some robustness checks of the strategies. I computed the mark-to-market value of CDS using different methods. So rather than using credit grades, I actually simply use the CDS spreads as discount factors to discount the cash flows. So this is very similar to Duffy and Singleton, where they show that you can actually adjust the short rate using default risk, a default risk adjusted short rate. So I'm just using the CDS spread as the adjustment. And I did that, and the result didn't change that much. And I can choose to update the hedge ratio daily rather than having a static hedge. And that didn't help very much either because the hedge is very much imperfect in the first place. The correlation between equity price changes and CDS price changes was very low to start with. So it doesn't matter if you change the hedge ratio every day or every week or just keep it the same. It doesn't really help change your result that much. Also change the CDS market bid-ask spread. I assume the 5% bid-ask spread, you can boost it to 10% and you still have a significant profit coming out of the strategy. And finally, also look at option implied volatility versus historical volatility. So one criticism to this is historical volatility is fairly constant. It doesn't really change. And we know that options might bring a lot more information to the market. So I actually looked at short-term at-the-money implied Black-Scholes implied volatilities, and what I found was that measure actually has a lot of noise. And what it did help was for those speculative grade issuers when they ran into problems. And that's when you use option implied volatility can actually help you generate a predicted spread that more or less matches the market spread level. Okay, but I have this part is not written into this paper yet. So I think in terms of this volatility problem, I think it would be very useful if you actually think about having a structural model with stochastic volatility, and then think because you know the CDS options on stock, and there you can think of all of this as contingent claims on the firm value within a unified Merton sort of type of model. And then it really is what exactly is the volatility that you put in. So implying the volatility from a one-month stock option is probably inappropriate for pricing a five-year contract. So then you have to make adjustments using a stochastic volatility model. But I haven't done that yet. Okay, so to summarize, capital structure arbitrage is a bet on convergence. And while convergence is not the norm, and you see large losses, especially at times of a crisis, and that's when the market spread continues to increase and diverge from the model value. However, so having said that, this observation is for individual trades. If you construct a return index based on all of these individual trades, what you find is that the strategy actually gives you very attractive Sharpe ratios that's very similar, maybe even higher than common hedge fund Sharpe ratios. So, and then also trying to explain what is generating this return, you run these factor regressions, and what I find is that we don't really have a lot of, we don't have a good explanation for why that there is such an attractive Sharpe ratio. In other words, the excess returns are not explained away by common market risk factors. So that's my conclusion here. And also, this gives rise to statistical arbitrage. Now, this actually continues as I was writing this paper. A few weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal reported that banks and hedge funds are running into losses on credit derivatives because of declining credit quality. So that may be, you know, maybe they're putting on these short positions and they were burned by these financial distressed obligors. Now, a week after that, many hedge funds lost money because of General Motors. And that was when General Motors was on the verge of being downgraded, so the CDS spread went very high, But then the equity price stayed around $20. It didn't really go down. So there is this relative value opportunity. The CDS spread is very high, but the theoretical spread based on equity remains fairly low. So then a trading strategy is to short CDS and then short equity. Well, what happened then was it was really downgraded, so the CDS spread really went to a very high level, but the equity price went up because Kirk Kerkorian put in a $31 per share acquisition of GM shares. So it just threw the whole relationship out of the window, and these arbitragers lost money on both sides. And this was reported as a well-publicized case, but if you look at the correlation on a very broad scale, you see correlation between CDS and equity actually being fairly low. So this episode actually is repeated times and times again in my sample. So this is actually a very common situation. So that's it. Questions?